What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
On the afternoon of February 23, 1987, Laureen Potter stopped by her daughter Jay Potter Mintz's home in Leland, North Carolina. Inside, she found Jay's 2-year-old son crying and 23-year-old Jay brutally murdered in bed. The crime scene was horrific, and local investigators immediately called in the State Bureau of Investigation. But despite decades of investigation and DNA left behind by the killer, no suspect has ever been identified, leaving whoever murdered Jay free nearly 40 years later. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so before we get into Jay's case, I do want to warn everybody that if you're someone who's sensitive when it involves children, although, thank God, no children were hurt in this case physically, it does appear that Jay's son was present when she was murdered, and that may be tough for some of you, so I just want to give you a heads up. This is one of those investigations where I'm surprised that I haven't heard of it before, because on the surface, there's going to be a couple scenarios we can go over. This could be connected to something much larger. And what I mean by that is it could be a serial killer. And I know a lot of people throw that word out there all the time. Oh, it's a serial killer. It's a serial killer. I am more hesitant to do that because I do think in most instances, the cases involve someone who's local who just happens to be a psychopath, and they may have killed one or two people, but they're not going on a killing spree across the country. They're not the Long Island serial killer or Golden State killer. With this particular case, the circumstances surrounding it, it could align with someone who had a particular MO when they would go into a certain area and they would look for their victims of opportunity before killing them and then moving on. But then on the other hand, I'm going to bring up some counterpoints where you do wonder if it was someone who was a complete stranger to Jay, how would they know certain things? How would they feel safe inside her home? But we're going to go over all of it. And as usual, you guys are going to come back in the comments and let me know if you agree or disagree, which is why I love what we're doing. I love the respectful dialogue and ultimately the goal that we all have, which is to solve these investigations. So we have a lot to cover. Let's dive into this week's case. Beverly J. Potter, who went by Jay, was born on December 5th, 1963 to her parents Laureen and William. Jay, who was described as smart, positive, and very shy until she got to know someone, grew up in North Carolina in a close-knit family alongside her sister Jill. Their mother, Laureen, was a twin, so they were also raised with their cousins. They spent a lot of time together and loved riding horses. In high school, Jay started dating Billy Mintz. After graduating, she became pregnant, and the two got married. In 1983, they welcomed their first child, a son named BJ. Not long afterward, Jay and Billy separated. Billy joined the army, and the couple eventually reconciled. In February of 1985, they welcomed their second son, Andrew. Around that time, Billy was stationed in Germany, and Jay moved there with the boys. But the marriage fell apart once again, and this time they were separated for good. Jay returned to North Carolina with her sons, and they settled into a family cottage at Route 3, Box 251A in Leland, a small town just outside of Wilmington. At the time, there were fewer than 2,000 residents. The cottage had been in Jay's family since 1923. It sat on a large corner lot approximately half a mile from her parents' home. The road was busy, with both vehicles and pedestrian traffic traveling to nearby grocery stores, restaurants, and other businesses. It was also located approximately a mile from US Highway 17. Jay's cousin, Angela, moved into the cottage with her young daughter. As they settled into the home, Jay focused on building a new life. She took a job as a waitress at the Hong Kong restaurant in Wilmington and began dating again. By late February of 1987, Jay was busy with life but also preparing for Andrew's second birthday, which was on February 24th. So she was planning this big celebration for him, and to help Jay get everything ready, because obviously you're trying to juggle multiple things, her mother, Laureen, took BJ on February 23rd so they could run errands together and pick up Andrew's birthday cake. At approximately 9:30 that morning, just before leaving the house, Laureen received a phone call from a man asking about a waterbed she had advertised in the local newspaper. Now, this ad was actually for Jay's waterbed, and at the time, the newspaper was offering 1 week of free classified advertising. And Jay had already used her free listing, but the waterbed hadn't sold. So Laureen placed another ad using her own number so she could get it for free again. So that was why this man called Laureen on the morning of February 23rd and not Jay. And Laureen later recalled, quote, "He had a very ordinary voice, not a southern one, not a northern one. It wasn't heavy or high. It was just normal." Laureen gave the man directions to Jay's house, and after hanging up, she called Jay to let her know that someone was on their way, and Jay said that the waterbed had already been sold, it just hadn't been picked up yet. Laureen responded by saying, "Just tell the man it's no longer available and don't let him inside to look at it." And that would be the last time they would ever speak. A little after noon, Laureen stopped by Jay's house. She knocked on the door, but no one answered. When she tried the door, she realized it was unlocked, which she thought was unusual. Laureen went inside, calling out for Jay, but the house was silent. Then she heard Andrew crying and followed the sound to Jay's back bedroom. There, Laureen found Andrew sitting at the foot of Jay's waterbed. He told her, quote, "Mean man hurt mommy, mommy cry." 23-year-old Jay was lying on the bed motionless. Her hands were bound behind her back with nylon rope. A pillowcase had been put over her head, and she had suffered 7 stab wounds to her chest and back. Later, an autopsy would show that she had also been raped. Laureen's first instinct was to help her daughter, so she pulled the pillowcase away, and that's when she realized that Jay's throat had been cut so deeply that her head had nearly severed from her body. And so at that point, Laureen realizes that Jay's gone, so she grabs Andrew and she runs to a nearby florist shop, and there she calls 911. Deputies with the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office arrived to find a bloody and gruesome crime scene unlike anything they were accustomed to. At the time, the county averaged approximately 1 homicide every other month, but investigators said they had never seen one like Jay's. They immediately requested assistance from the State Bureau of Investigation, also known as the SBI. Investigators processed the home and noted there were no signs of forced entry. The front door was locked, which was normal. However, the back door had been unlocked when Laureen arrived, which stood out as odd to her. Near the back door, investigators found a single drop of blood on the linoleum, so based on that evidence and the fact that the back door had been unlocked when Laureen arrived, investigators believe that the killer had left through the back door. In Jay's bedroom, investigators recovered several important pieces of evidence. They found the local newspaper with the waterbed ad circled, along with the killer's DNA on the bedsheets, the pillows, and Jay's body. USA Today reported that despite the brutality of the attack and the depth of Jay's wounds, the waterbed itself did not have a single puncture. The knife used to kill Jay was not there and didn't appear to come from Jay's house. The same could be said for the nylon rope, leading investigators to theorize that the knife and rope were brought there by the killer. And because they found no usable fingerprints, they also believed that the killer had likely worn gloves. All of this told investigators that this was a planned attack. It was premeditated. However, they wouldn't go as far to say that he was fully in control of the scene. And that was interesting to me. I didn't completely grasp it. Maybe you guys will have some thoughts on it, but let me give you the quote. The investigator said, "There were some things that occurred that indicated at some point in time during the commission of the crime, the suspect may have been in control of himself, but then at another point, he was not." And so when I hear this, I divide it into two potential categories. One being when they say he was not in control, they're talking about physical control of himself, where most of the crime scene appeared to be calculated and methodical. And maybe there were moments where it looked like something occurred in a fit of rage, maybe the stab wounds themselves, where everything was kind of laid out, but the way she was stabbed, the way she was basically almost decapitated, that to them was a sign where the offender lost control for a minute. On the other hand, they could be referring to the crime scene itself, right? Everything appeared to be calculated and set up for this particular occurrence. Jay was tied to the bed. It was in the back room. It appeared that the killer had came through the back door. And yet maybe there was a moment where you could see a sign of struggle where when he attacked Jay initially, he didn't have control. She was fighting back. And maybe there were some signs on her that she had defensive wounds. So again, without all the details, I don't know exactly what they're referring to, but I would love to hear your thoughts. In addition to processing the crime scene, investigators spoke with Andrew to determine whether he had witnessed anything that morning. According to Jay's cousin, who later spoke to the Huffington Post, quote, "One thing he remembered was a knock at the back door. Jay looked out the peephole and she didn't see anybody, so she opened the door and the man immediately came in. He said the man was a white male, someone he didn't know." Andrew also remembered that the man was holding a knife and made a stabbing motion as he described what he saw. At the time, he didn't realize his mother had died and he believed she was still coming back. As he got older, those memories faded and he no longer remembered what happened that day. But I just want to point out that being 2 years old and being as descriptive as he was is incredible. I don't think my two-year-olds could have done that. And what he had to say was also very important to this case. The fact that he described him as a white male, the fact that he was able to describe how this man got into the home, and also that it wasn't someone he was familiar with. And to me, this right here is a good indication that this was a stranger. This wasn't someone known to Jade or Andrew, because if they were, the likelihood of this person leaving Andrew behind alive, very unlikely. But because they had never encountered Andrew before, they weren't concerned about him saying, oh, it was so-and-so. So for whatever reason, I'm not saying this murderer is a good person, but they decided to spare Andrew because they weren't concerned about him identifying them down the road. And so just to recap, we have a white man who appears to be a stranger and doesn't have a Southern accent, even though they're in North Carolina. So more indications that this is someone who's not from there and just passing through, possibly a transient. As investigators continued their interviews, they spoke to potential witnesses in the area surrounding Jay's home. A roofing crew had been working across the street all morning, but no one on the crew reported seeing or hearing anything suspicious. Other nearby witnesses, unfortunately, said the same thing. And that really surprised investigators. Jay was murdered in broad daylight at a house located along a busy road, and there was a restaurant less than 1/10 of a mile away, a flower shop next door, and roofers working directly across the street. Yet somehow, the killer arrived, murdered Jay, and left without anyone seeing or hearing anything unusual. And I don't think this is some conspiracy. I don't think there's a cover-up here. It's just bad luck. It's as simple as that. Sometimes when you're working these cases, you get lucky and sometimes you don't. Investigators also spoke with family members, friends, and anybody else who knew Jay, and no one could think of anyone who wanted to hurt her. The murder came as a complete shock to everyone. Her cousin said, quote, "She didn't have an enemy in the world. She had a heart of gold. She was always nice to everyone and never said an unkind word. Talk to anyone who knew her and they'll all say the same things. She was a sweet, wonderful person. We don't understand how anyone could hurt someone like her." And listen, that's how these cases go. These monsters out there, they don't have a conscience. They have one thing in mind. They want to get their gratification and they don't see others as human beings, just pawns in their game. And when you look up Jay, if you're watching on YouTube, yeah, she was an amazing person. She was also beautiful, absolutely stunning. And the fact that this house was located on a busy road, yeah, you would like to think that someone would have seen something. And in most cases, maybe they would have. But here, the way it went down, they didn't. And I do want to bring up something before we go any further, because I did go on Google Earth. And one thing with Google Earth that I love is you can go back in time and see what it was like around the time whenever the crime occurred. And in this particular scenario, when you look at the location where the cottage was located and you look at it now, it's kind of built up more. In fact, I couldn't even see the house specifically that I was looking for, but I can see the residential neighborhood around it. It's much more developed now. But when you go back to around 1990, you can clearly see the cottage, and behind it, there's a lot of woods and there's like a playground down the road. And I do wonder if the suspect drove up to the area, kind of cased the place a little bit, realized that it was on a busy road and didn't want to run the risk of their car being seen or them being seen. So if you look on the side there, if you drive down that side road, there is that playground area where you could park a car and then walk through the woods, and it would bring you right to the back door. So if everything else was planned, is it hard to believe that in the moment this was planned as well, where they did a quick kind of search of the property and realized going through the front door wasn't the best approach for multiple reasons? And so they have the knife, the rope, gloves, they park on the side road, and they walk right through those woods, and nobody ever sees them. I also want to add that I know my part-time detectives out there are saying, well, did they try to trace the phone call? And you would be right. That would be critical information if they were able to obtain it. But you have to remember, it was 1987. So they did try to trace the phone call. They tried to find out where the call had originated from that went to Laureen. But unfortunately, again, with the lack of technology at the time, it was extremely difficult and they were unable to do so. And we still have more to cover, because although it's looking like a certain profile for the offender, there are some other scenarios we have to explore, and we're going to talk about it after the break. If you've tried everything to lose weight and still feel stuck, this summer can be different. Weight Loss by Hers is designed to support you in reaching your goals with access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep the weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 pill for weight loss, so there's no needles involved. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. And if prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and much more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. If you're ready to reach your goals, visit forhers.com/detective to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/detective. Once again, that's forhers.com/detective. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is a registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. All right, we're back from break. And as we've kind of deduced, it doesn't appear that Jay knew her killer. But there were no immediate suspects at that point, and investigators were not going to leave any stone unturned. So they started looking into every man that Jay had dated or met. They later told the media that they ended up receiving an unusual level of cooperation from the men they interviewed. No one asked for an attorney. Instead, they all volunteered to provide blood and hair samples to eliminate themselves as suspects. They also all agreed to take polygraph examinations administered by the SBI. Detectives compared those results with verified alibis and DNA tests and were ultimately able to rule out everyone they investigated. And this is just a case of a small local community. Everyone knows everyone. And the last thing you want is people thinking that you killed this young woman. So whatever it takes, they're willing to work with law enforcement to exonerate themselves, to clear themselves. And that's exactly what they did. They say it's unusual because even if it seems reasonable, we all know that there are times where someone could say or do something that gets themselves in hot water. And the reality is they had nothing to do with the crime. So in this particular case, it just worked out where the people that they did identify were willing to come forward, talk to them, provide their DNA tests, do the polys, give them their alibis for where they were on that particular day and time, and they were able to move on rather quickly from these people and focus on others, because that's not the only people they looked into. They also looked into several men who had been stalking or harassing Jay in the months leading up to her murder. One man would write, "I love you, Jay," in the gravel driveway outside the house. Another man left a single rose for Jay at the restaurant where she worked, and on one occasion, he followed her from store to store while she was off work. He told her that he loved her, and he begged her to move in with him. As you might expect, Jay was afraid of this guy and often had her co-workers walk her to her car after work. Then, after Jay listed the waterbed for sale, she began receiving strange phone calls. The caller appeared to know her schedule, repeatedly calling her just before she left for work and shortly after she returned home. Angela, Jay's cousin, who, as I mentioned earlier, moved in with her, she said the calls were sexual in nature, and depending on who answered, the caller would taunt either Jay or Angela. And I will say, at this point, it's unclear if detectives ever identified the people responsible for stalking and harassing Jay. What investigators have said is that they've ruled out everyone they knew she had been acquainted with. In the end, detectives concluded that Jay most likely did not know the person who killed her, and I agree with that assessment for a lot of the reasons we've already mentioned. Number one reason being, Andrew didn't recognize the person. They didn't know him. And just to reaffirm that assumption, the fact that the killer left Andrew around to tell this story, I think that right there solidifies it. On top of that, it appears that the suspect wasn't aware of Jay until the advertisement of the waterbed. If they had known Jay previously, the ad would have been inconsequential. It wouldn't have mattered. They would have done what they wanted to do to her long ago. They wouldn't have needed the ad. On the other hand, you could make the argument that they were using that as a cover, right? They wanted to be able to access the home or get close to the home without raising any concerns. Now, I go back and forth on this, and I hope you guys are as well, because I want the debate, right? There is part of me, and I would save this for the perspective, but I'm going to go with it now because I may not remember it at the end. I have so many notes here. On one hand, everything aligns with this being a stranger. But on the other hand, if this crime was premeditated, they had the rope, they had the knife, how did they know it wasn't a dude selling the waterbed, right? How did they know that this woman, Jay, didn't have a husband or boyfriend who was right around the corner and would be walking into the house the minute they did? How would they determine all of this if this was just a random act of violence where they had done no counterintelligence on the house prior to attacking her? Now, there could be a small window here where the killer sees the advertisement, gets the address, and watches the house for a few hours. And during that time, they see Jay through the windows, or maybe she comes outside and they don't see any activity. They don't see a second vehicle. They don't see a man come or go. And so they just didn't care and took the risk. It could be as simple as that, where, okay, I've been here for a few hours and nothing's gone on. So I'm going to park on the side. I'm going to go in. I'm going to do what I want to do and I'm going to get out. Possible. Maybe they saw that advertisement and maybe that wasn't the first time that they've called an advertisement. And maybe during those occasions when they arrived at the home, they saw a situation that wasn't advantageous to them. Maybe it was a man or multiple people or whatever the case may be, and they decided not to act. But in this particular circumstance, it fit. It was exactly what they were looking for. Please discuss that in the comments, because I even as I sit here and record this, I go back and forth. I debate myself on it throughout the day. So I am still leaning towards a stranger who just looked quickly and said, yep, it's good enough and went for it. But there are points where I say to myself, man, this was a risk. This was a risk and they could have easily been identified. If you remember, Angela lived at that home as well. She could have walked right in. So there are some questions that I have, but listen, if there weren't questions, this case would be solved. So sorry for going on that tangent. I know that's usually the perspective, but I've been wanting to get to that since the top of the show. And so I'm proud of myself for waiting this long, but we'll carry on in the story. So the investigation continued, and by 1989, investigators still had no answers. In an effort to generate new leads, a task force was formed to investigate Jay's murder. They reviewed similar cases from around the country and identified several persons of interest, but despite those efforts, detectives were never able to establish any connection to Jay's murder. Meanwhile, life continued for Jay's family. Her parents raised her two boys, and Laureen struggled deeply with what had happened. She suffered from terrible nightmares and called the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office every single day to ask for an update on the case. Jay's sister Jill later told Dateline that Laureen carried tremendous guilt over giving the caller directions to Jay's house that morning. She said, quote, she lived with so much pain and guilt for the rest of her life. Her heart was broken. And this one hurts. This one really hurts because as a parent, you're there to protect your children. And in no way, shape, or form is Laureen responsible for what happened to Jay. There's one person responsible for that. But if I'm being a realist with you guys, if I were in Laureen's shoes, I would feel the exact same way. I would ask myself every day, even though it was so just natural, right? You got someone calling for an ad. There's an ad in the paper. You're thinking it's a good thing. You're helping your daughter out. She's about to get rid of this waterbed, make some money. So there's nothing wrong with what she did. But in hindsight, you're always going to beat yourself up over that. What if I didn't give him that address? What if I didn't pick up my phone? Would my daughter still be alive to this day? And I wouldn't be honest with you guys if I didn't sit here and say that no matter what someone told me, if I were Laureen, I would always feel that guilt. I would always feel that pain. And just a horrible situation. Absolutely terrible. And when I heard this quote for the first time, I sat there for a minute and was like, yeah, I get it. I would be in the exact same position. I would never, ever forgive myself for that. But sitting here with you guys, Laureen shouldn't carry that guilt. There's a monster out there. And they were looking for someone. And if it wasn't Jay, it would have been someone else. Unfortunately, the situation was what it was. But that is not Laureen's fault. She did nothing wrong. And Laureen wasn't the only one who struggled with Jay's death. Jay's estranged husband, Billy, who we talked about at the beginning of this episode, he also struggled with depression in the aftermath of Jay's murder. And in 1993, at just 29 years old, he died by suicide. Then in 2000, USA Today published a long-form article about Jay's murder, bringing national attention to the case. And after it was published, hundreds of law enforcement officers across the country contacted the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office, reporting similar murders in their own jurisdictions. Detectives looked into each lead and identified several cases with similarities, but once again, none of them produced any evidence that led to Jay's killer. As the years passed, they kept looking into similar cases and testing DNA evidence against potential suspects, but nothing panned out. And by February of 2007, 20 years had passed since Jay's murder. Laureen spoke with WECT about the pain she continued to carry. She said, quote, I can't even explain how bad it's been. I can't explain how bad it was the day I found her either. It broke my heart. Tragically, just a few months later, Laureen died of a heart attack. She was only 63 years old. It's bad enough that we lost her, but to lose her under those circumstances while she was carrying that guilt, it's hard to fathom. It's hard to put into words. And it's unfortunate that she passed away not knowing what truly happened to her daughter and who was responsible for it, because maybe, not always the case, but maybe that person would have shed some light onto what actually happened. And gave us a little bit more of the specifics about how they conducted themselves on that day and whether or not the phone call was even part of what happened. We keep talking about this call that Lorraine took that morning from this man as if we know for sure he was the killer. And the reality is we don't. It could be a coincidence. Yes, I'm not sitting here saying that it doesn't look that way, especially when you consider the fact that the advertisement for the waterbed was found in the home and it was circled. But it also could be someone else. It also could be someone else who knew about this ad and used that as their point of entry. So maybe we would get some answers there, where imagine if this person came out and said, I killed her and I never called anyone. It's not going to make Lorraine feel any better about what happened, but it would at least lift that guilt of thinking that she's the reason her daughter was murdered. And so the investigation continued, but for years there was very little movement. Then in the early 2010s, Jay's family hired Dr. Maurice Godwin, a forensic criminal investigative psychologist, to review the case. He was given access to the investigative files and spent thousands of hours reviewing the evidence and reconstructing the crime scene. After completing his review, Dr. Godwin spoke with the Star News and shared several details investigators had not publicly discussed. He said that Jay's body had been positioned in a, quote, sexual manner, and that part of the pillow remained on her face. He also said that the type of nylon rope and the way the rope had been tied suggested the killer may have had boating experience. So based on everything he reviewed, Dr. Godwin said, quote, you're dealing with a case that has all the hallmarks of a serial killer. He also believed that one of the reasons the case had remained unsolved was because of the mistakes made during the initial investigation. For example, according to Dr. Godwin, investigators never attempted to obtain Jay's phone records despite reports that someone had been calling her house and hanging up in the days leading up to her murder. Dr. Godwin also pointed to a man who lived next door to Jay. He said the neighbor had easy access to the back door investigators believe the killer used to enter the house, and the neighbor had never been interviewed until Dr. Godwin spoke with him. Godwin said, quote, he was at work when it happened, but his wife was home on the opposite side of the house and supposedly never heard anything. While this neighbor lead didn't pan out, to Dr. Godwin, it showed how many holes were in the investigation. And he didn't stop there because he also pointed to another mislead, saying it was unclear whether Jay's fingernails had been scraped for DNA. Dr. Godwin also revealed that he had offered to pay for additional DNA testing himself. His goal was to use the DNA recovered from the crime scene for facial reconstruction and investigative genetic genealogy in the hopes of identifying someone connected to the Leland area. And according to him, I have no way to confirm this, he said that the sheriff's office believed he was asking for too much and he was removed from the case. So after that, he was no longer allowed to review any investigative files. Here's what I'll say about this whole thing, and there's a lot to unpack here. And we have to remember we're only getting one side of the story because as far as I can tell, the sheriff's office has never responded to Dr. Godwin or spoken negatively about him. But there's a couple things we can look at. On one hand, if what he's alleging, Dr. Godwin is saying, as far as them not obtaining Jay's phone records, not scraping under her nails, not interviewing the immediate neighbors around the cottage, he's right. It's a huge misstep, and it does give me some current, and it does raise some concern when you think about other parts of the investigation and what may not have been done. But I will also say this. It is rare, as you guys know, for law enforcement agencies to allow an independent party to come in and have access to all the files. God, do I know that to be true. Even as a former detective, even with some of the things that I've done in this field, law enforcement is still very apprehensive to let me or anybody else come in and look at their work because they have a fear that it could get out, right? Information could be disseminated that they don't want to be known by the public. There's also another side to it where they just don't like people questioning their work, but we'll save that for another day. But on that note, Dr. Godwin did exactly what these law enforcement agencies fear. He went to a media outlet and starts talking about the case, describing certain things at the crime scene that weren't publicly known that could have been guilt knowledge, and then actively criticizing the investigation. So when you look at it from that perspective, if you're the sheriff's office, are you going to want this person coming into your building? I'll be honest, I don't. So I understand where they're coming from as well. Regardless, it does not excuse the mistakes that were made, if they were in fact made. And I will say, for what it's worth, after Dr. Godwin was removed, the new current lead investigator was assigned to the case. The person who's working it right now, they were assigned after Dr. Godwin was taken off of it. So where we stand right now with it, you can come to your own conclusions. I'm trying to present the facts, but like I said, the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office has not responded to these allegations, so we don't know how much of it is true. But I would like to think that Dr. Godwin putting this out there, I don't think he's just putting out flat-out lies. And so if there was something to dispute, I feel that the sheriff's office would have done that and said, nope, he's wrong. We did do this, this, and this. To kind of wrap this part up, what Dr. Godwin is suggesting be done is also something that I was going to say in the perspective, but again, I'll say it now. DNA, DNA, DNA. That's the key to cracking this case. Investigative genetic genealogy is something that needs to be done and rechecked every year as science and technology continues to evolve. And I know Dr. Godwin offered the money. I will offer the money as well through Criminal Coffee. We can fund it. If there's DNA that can be sequenced, that we can put into a system and see if there's any distant relatives of this person, that's the way we solve it. That's how they solved Golden State Killer. Maybe this person who committed the crime has stayed off the radar, but maybe a distant cousin decided to submit their test to a website where they opted into a law enforcement using it, and now they have a connection. They have a lead to follow. They can reverse engineer it. So yes, I'm putting it out there as well. I know Dr. Godwin offered. I'm offering as well. If they need money to do this genealogical testing, it's there for them. That should not be a barrier to entry. As the years passed, coverage of Jay's case became limited. And in 2016, Jay's father passed away as well. 5 years later, in 2021, Dateline worked with Jay's surviving family to bring renewed attention to the case. The lead investigator provided an update saying, quote, "We don't consider Jay's case a cold case. It's just unsolved. I put as much energy and care into her case as I would want if it were me or someone I loved." The investigator said numerous people have been questioned extensively over the years, but no concrete evidence has ever connected anyone to Jay's murder. They also said they remained hopeful that advances in DNA technology would eventually produce answers from the evidence collected at the crime scene, but so far those efforts have not generated any new leads. And if this case wasn't already sad enough, in November of 2024, tragedy struck again when Jay's youngest son, Andrew, who witnessed everything, passed away at 39 years old. He was survived by his wife and two children, including a daughter he had named Beverly after his mother's birth name. Following Andrew's death, his family wrote in their Facebook group, Justice for Jay, quote, "He spent his life carrying the weight of this tragedy, and now, more than ever, we are determined to find the truth. For Jay, for Andrew, and for everyone who loved them." Unfortunately, there have been no other major developments in Jay's investigation. More than 39 years after her murder, the case remains unsolved and her family continues searching for answers, hoping one day Jay's killer will be behind bars. All right, let's get into this perspective, and it's going to be on the shorter side because, frankly, I gave a lot of my perspective throughout the episode because I just couldn't wait. But I really already talked about the whole scenario of this being a stranger, not connected to Jay, seeing the advertisement and using that as an opportunity to get the address and then casing the place for a little bit and then going through the back door. But there are some other scenarios that we have to consider, even if they're less likely. And first off, that could be the person who originally purchased the waterbed. Have they been vetted? Have they been talked to? They were supposed to come by and pick the bed up. I'm assuming they had already had conversations with Jay, so they would have known her current living situation. They would have seen her. Like I said, she was an attractive woman, and they could have came back, but with different intentions. The second scenario we have to look at is that, yes, the advertisement is what brought attention to Jay's home. And maybe she was having conversations with multiple people who had inquired about the waterbed during the first ad. And maybe during one of those conversations, she had disclosed her address if they wanted to come by and take a look at it. Well, if what Dr. Godwin is saying is true, and law enforcement did not obtain her phone records, is it possible that one of the people that she was communicating with could have come by, but again, with ulterior motives? They had no intention on buying the waterbed. And then the third scenario that I'm not giving up on is the possibility that although law enforcement believes they've spoke to every single person that Jay had a connection to, are there other individuals that we're unaware of? Young woman living alone on this busy street. She probably had some secret admirers from the restaurant. Is it possible that they may have followed her home, that they may have knew her schedule? And when this ad came out, that's when the stalking increased, where she started receiving those phone calls. And so although they had been lurking and watching her for a while, they never actually engaged and exposed themselves. So unlike some of the other people I mentioned about the rose and the gravel and following her from store to store, what if there are other men like that who we did not identify? And when this advertisement came out, they saw that as their way in. They saw that as an opportunity to go to the house, get closer, maybe approach the house. And if someone spotted them, they could use the excuse that they were there for the waterbed ad. But in that scenario, it would answer some of the questions that I posed to you guys earlier. How would this person know that, one, it's a young woman who's living alone in this house? How would they know that Angela would not be home during that particular time? How did they know that Jay wasn't married or had a boyfriend who lived with her and would be home very soon? These things to me are questions that, as I sit here right now, I can't answer under the template that this was a complete stranger. And so here's my compromise. Here's my middle. Yes, it's a complete stranger to Jay, but Jay is not a complete stranger to this person. They knew her. They had been following her. They did their research on her, even though she didn't know them. So yes, Andrew would not recognize this person when they entered their home. But that doesn't mean this person hadn't seen Andrew before. And you see where I'm going with this? That to me would fill some of those voids where you would have the opportunity to do some preliminary research, gather the things you'll need for what you want to do, and feel relatively confident that you could go in through that back door and not be seen or heard by anyone. That also would lean towards someone who's from the Leland area and not just passing through. But even if this person is from the Leland area, it doesn't mean they're not a serial killer. It doesn't mean that after this occurred, they didn't commit other crimes just like this, maybe throughout the country. And so it's just a matter of communicating with other agencies and make sure that we're comparing notes and hoping that something pops. But if that doesn't happen, as I just said a few moments ago, it's gonna be the DNA. We're fortunate enough to have it here, and we've seen the cases we've been able to solve purely because of DNA, and I'm hoping that this is another one on that list. And I'll just reiterate for Brunswick County and everybody else who's listening, I am willing to provide the money for the DNA testing. I also have the lab resources. And oh, by the way, I happen to own a PI firm and have two amazing genealogists who have solved multiple cases using IgG. So we're here at your disposal and we want to catch this guy. And even if he's done a good job of keeping himself out of those systems, maybe a relative hasn't. And as I always say, there could be someone from that area who witnessed something and didn't think it was a big deal, so they didn't come forward. Or it could be someone who had a partner or a friend or a family member and saw some suspicious behavior on the day of the murder and for some reason decided not to report it, maybe because they care about this person or they didn't think it was a big deal. Those people could be out there and they may have information that could be the missing link between two pieces of evidence. They just have to come forward. So just to recap, 23-year-old Jay Potter Mintz was found murdered inside her home in Leland, North Carolina on February 23, 1987. Investigators found no signs of forced entry and recovered the killer's DNA from the crime scene. Despite decades of investigation, numerous interviews, and advances in DNA testing, no one has ever been charged with Jay's murder. More than 39 years later, Jay's case remains unsolved, and investigators continue searching for the person responsible. Anyone with information is asked to call the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office at 910-253-2777. And as always, my final words go out to the friends and family of Jay, specifically her son BJ and her sister Jill. I'm thinking of you guys. We're all thinking of you. No family should have to go through what you've been through. And all I can think of right now, and this will depend on what you subscribe to, what you believe in, is that Laureen, William, and Andrew are with her. They're not feeling pain anymore. But you guys are still here. And we need to get justice for you and the rest of your family, the family that has to live with that pain every single day. And here's the good news about this case. And I don't say this lightly because I don't like to provide false hope. I'm really optimistic this case is going to get solved. You have something that most cases don't have, DNA. And I don't need to tell you that right now, the DNA is the hero in a lot of these cases that are being solved when they were deemed unsolvable. So the fact that we have that and you have a community supporting you and now you have our community supporting you along with the financial resources that I can provide if needed, I'm feeling good about this one. And I'm really hoping that now that everyone's hearing this story and Brunswick County Sheriff's Office is aware that I'm willing to get involved and I'm willing to help out in any way that I can, I'm hoping that it rejuvenates this case a little bit more and maybe we go back into the evidence files, take a look at that DNA, and maybe take another shot at it. What do we have to lose? It's been almost 40 years. Let's go for it now. Let's see what we can find. And let's hope that we can find this monster and bring them to justice. I'm really hoping that happens sooner than later, not only for you and your family, but for that entire community that's been affected by this tragedy, even 40 years later. Until then, please, everyone stay safe out there. I'll see you soon.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.